Section 5. Stephen's Trial Speech. I've already noted Burton Mack's observation that the sermons used to persuade Jews to become Christians all throughout Acts are simply not believable history. In general, we know the standard practice in antiquity, even for the soberest of historians, was to fabricate the speeches of historical actors, based on what the historian was sure they must have said, as I noted in Element 44. They were rarely likely to have sources for the content of speeches anyway, and even when they had them, they were rarely likely to use them if they didn't agree with the story the author wanted to tell. And we can often tell this is what happened. Consider, for example, the longest speech in all of Acts, that of Stephen, delivered to the Sanhedrin immediately before he is executed by stoning, Acts 6 verse 9 to Acts 8 verse 2. In the presence of Paul, and with his approval, then called Saul, in Acts 7 verse 58 and Acts 8 verse 1. There are historical inaccuracies in this account as we have it. Mishnah law required that a capital sentence be voted on the day after the trial, so the judges could think on it before taking a life, whereas Acts has the court stone him instantly, without even a vote. But that could be explained as a truncation of what really happened, or as part of the original fiction Luke may have been using as his source. Similarly, Stephen's speech draws on the Septuagint, a popular Greek translation of the Old Testament, perhaps an odd thing to do for a supposed native of Palestine in a Jerusalem courtroom, where summarizing the Hebrew original would be more expected. And he does this, though, complete with errors only present in the Septuagint, but that could be a reflection, again, of either its author's method of composing the fiction or Stephen's. Those elements don't concern us that much, but the overall content does. Stephen's speech is also unique in Acts in many other respects. For its content, its construction, its length, and its being assigned to an otherwise insignificant speaker. Stephen is only suddenly and inexplicably introduced in Acts 6 verse 5 so as to immediately become the first Christian executed for the faith. A strange course of events, given that Peter and John were twice tried for the exact same crimes and repeatedly acquitted, suggesting a huge narrative inconsistency that might again reflect Luke's employment of different sources, one treating the story of Paul, another Peter and John, or else his remarkable ineptitude as an author. Stephen himself is likely a fictional creation, a stock character representing a generic martyr. His name, Stephanos, meaning crown, evokes the standard epithet for a faithful Christian and martyr. Revelation 2 verse 10 encourages all Christians, quote, "Be faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life, Stephanos tes zdois," end quote. And James 1 verse 12 says, "All who remain faithful in the face of temptation will," quote, "receive the crown of life, Stephanos tes zdois," end quote. Also, 1 Peter 5 verse 4 says that when Jesus appears to the faithful, quote, "You shall receive the crown of glory, Stephanos tes doxis," that never fades away, end quote. And 2 Timothy 4 verse 8 says martyrs, quote, "who love the appearing of Jesus," end quote, will receive, quote, "the crown of righteousness," end quote, Stephanos tes dikaiosunes, end quote. And notably, Jesus appears to Stephen immediately before he dies for the faith. Hebrews 2 verses 7 to 8 likewise says Jesus was, quote, "crowned with glory and honor," end quote, for his martyrdom. And the death of Stephen is indeed modeled on the death of Jesus. Like Jesus, Stephen forgives his killers just before his death. Compare Acts 7 verse 60 with Luke 23 verse 34. And just before they die, both Stephen and Jesus declare aloud that they give up their spirit to God. Just compare Acts 7 verse 59 with Luke 23 verse 46. Both deliver their last words, quote-unquote, with a great cry, phone megale, the exact same words in Greek. Just compare Acts 7 verse 60 with Luke 23 verse 46. Both have their garments taken and given away. Compare Acts 7 verse 58 with Luke 23 verse 24. And just as Jesus says in his trial that his accusers will see, quote, "the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power of God," end quote, Luke 22 verse 69, Stephen says in his trial that he indeed sees, quote, "the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God," end quote, Acts 7 verses 55 to 56. Yet his accusers don't, presumably because it is not yet the apocalypse. Luke has also borrowed elements from Mark. Like Jesus, Stephen is accused by false witnesses that his enemies drum up against him, adapting Mark 14, verses 55 to 59, to construct Acts 6, verses 11 to 14. And the false accusations are also the same. Stephen is accused of claiming that this Jesus the Nazarene was going to destroy the temple and change the laws, the same thing Jesus was charged with in Mark. Notably, even though we know Luke used Mark as a source in constructing his gospel, he omitted both of these details in his account of the arrest and trial of Jesus. He uses them, instead, only here. Yet we know he knew of them, so we can be certain Luke made a conscious choice to use those details, originally said of Jesus, in the account of Stephen instead, which is a clear sign of fabricating the story. There is also a curious parallel between the unnamed young man, Neoniskos, who has his garment torn away and flees naked at Jesus' arrest, Mark 14, verses 51 to 52, and the named young man, Neanias, Saul, that is, Paul, who is given the garments of Stephen's accusers, Acts 7, verse 58. So when Luke inserts into Stephen's speech a brief reference to the historicity of Jesus, the Jews betrayed and murdered Jesus, just like their fathers murdered the prophets who foretold his coming, Acts 7, verses 52 to 53, this could obviously be Luke importing his own narrative assumptions, particularly as he does not have Stephen provide any further detail, nor have the Sanhedrin argue the point with him. Or it could have been a charge of mere cosmic responsibility, since Stephen in fact says, quote, "Now you have become his betrayers and murderers because you received the law as an ordinance from angels and you did not keep it," end quote, implying it was their disobedience that compelled Christ's death and not their actually killing him. Either way, Luke just assumes there would be no argument, which is historically implausible, and no reason for Stephen to be any more specific, even though he has Stephen speak over 1,200 words, consuming 5 pages of Greek, needlessly summarizing, at tedious length, the whole biblical history of the Jews. Surely the miracles, ministry, trial, and fate of Jesus were far more important facts to mention in his defense, in Acts 7, verses 2 to 53. As thus an evident fiction constructed by Luke, Stephen's speech is of no use in supporting historicity.